Welcome to Tech Stuff, a production of iHeartRadio's How Stuff Works. Hey there, and welcome to this special bonus sponsored episode of Tech Stuff. I'm Jonathan Strickland. I'm an executive producer with How Stuff Works and iHeartRadio, and I love all things tech. And back in July 2019, IBM completed its acquisition of the company Red Hat, famed for its work in open source software. The companies invited me out to Red Hat headquarters, which does, in fact, have a big red hat on it, to talk about why the companies made this move, how they plan to work together, and ultimately, what does this mean for all of us? And so in this episode, you're going to hear sections of an interview I did with IBM's Steve Robinson and Red Hat's Ashish Badani. And I'll be popping in and out to give a bit more context and explanation. But first, I want to set the stage a bit. Now, we're mainly going to talk about cloud computing and open source software in this conversation. And the reason that this is a big deal is that more companies are putting more of their operations on the cloud. And there are a lot of different reasons to do this. One is to make sure that the services they provide are available whenever and wherever the end user needs them, whether the end user is someone else in the company, a different company, or a consumer like you or me. Another reason is to maximize resources. And there are tons of other reasons besides those that companies do this. What about the average user? You know, I don't run a global company with worldwide service, so why do I care about all this? Well, for me, it's about the utility and availability of the apps I run on all these different devices, whether it's a computer or a mobile phone, a tablet, whatever it might be. More of those apps are tapping into lots of different aspects that a company is involved with. So a bank, for example, could have an app that allows you to access your bank account. You can make transfers. You could pay bills. You could check your reward status on any credit cards you might have. You might be able to apply for loans and more. To the end user, it might seem like all that stuff just sort of lives in the brick and mortar building that the bank we use happens to be located in, but in reality, those services might be spread across numerous computer systems all over the place. Some of them might be on-premises at the bank itself. Some might be in a privately managed data center off-site. Some might depend upon large cloud computing services run by big companies. So there's a whole variety out there. Now, as an end user, I just expect that stuff to work. I expect all those services to be integrated into the app seamlessly. And it's frustrating when that's not the case, right? Like when you try to do something and either there's a long wait time or it doesn't work the way you expected. But the cloud computer landscape, it's a complicated one for reasons that we're going to get into in the discussions I had with Steve and Ashish. So making this happen, all this stuff working together, isn't as easy as just inserting a few links between services. So let's get started. I began with what seems like a simple question, but is actually fairly complicated. So I'm very pleased that I get to speak to two experts on this subject because about a decade ago, I wrote more than a dozen articles all about the concept of cloud computing. Back then, cloud computing, at least for the mainstream, was just creeping into the public consciousness, and there was a lot of confusion about it. And I think over the years, everyone has a better understanding of what cloud computing is, but the problem is everyone has a different understanding of what cloud computing is. So can we talk about the definition of cloud computing and how that has actually evolved over time?
You'd be happy to. And I think you hit the nail on the head with regards to, I think it's one of the most amorphous definitions out there. You ask anybody, I think they've got a different view. And I think we're at a period of time, at least in IBM's view, is that it's one that's continually redefining and is probably in a phase right now where it's being redefined as well. I think in most cases, people originally assumed and associated cloud with the large public clouds, you know, the multi-tenant hyperscalers. And it reminds me a little bit like the early days of the internet. You know, if you go back to the internet, you had extranet, you had internet, you had public internet, you had private internet. And before long, you started to see most of the vendors start to rally around a small set standards, TCP, IP, HTML. And before long, it just became the internet. You know, you would serve up a URL and you really didn't care where the server was that was serving up the content behind it. It could be in your data center, it could be on GoDaddy, it could be wherever that could be in one country versus another. It just became the internet. And I think in the cloud, we're kind of at that position too. I think the cloud is going to start to expand to be almost anywhere that I've got compute and data capabilities. And we've seen this whole rally around a certain set of standards really driving that, and driving that at a speed that's just unbelievable right now. I think, you know, the adoption of Linux, I think the whole history of containers and the maturity of containers, which are, you know, kind of, you know, finer grained virtualization that allows me to have code and move it around and pack middleware into it, et cetera. And then finally, Kubernetes, that gives me the ability to orchestrate and manage those containers, are kind of that becoming that lingua franca. You know, I think all of the major vendors are now kind of embracing those three standards. I think there's probably over 40 to 50 different distros of Kube today. And that's now, I think, kind of turning it into cloud. Can I do cloud in my data center? Sure, there's a lot of things I can do. I can run containers. I can run Kubernetes. I can build APIs. I can have always on. I can do a lot of cloud native concepts right in the data center. Can I do a dedicated cloud that may be set up and assigned to a single client or a single customer? Yep, you now have be able to do cloud concepts and put a single customer boundary around it as well. And then you've got the hyperscalers that can do that for a wide range and never know where you know my machine may be in one data center one day and one data center the next day. So I think all of this is becoming the cloud. And I think within the next couple of years, cloud will be anywhere that I'm doing kind of cloud native properties, independent of its final locality here. And this has kind of been the real basis of some of the work you guys have been doing in Red Hat.
Absolutely.
And the strategy there, right?
Yeah. And you're right about the definition of cloud sort of changing, right? So from this notion of cloud computing is when it just happened on somebody else's computer.
That's right.
Or somewhere else. And, you know, if we go back, right, I mean, you can ask yourself, look, where were people's expectations of this frame, right? Were they in the P2P sharing, you know, if anyone remembers that, right? So this notion of kind of, you know, music sharing or streaming, or even this notion that you had with regard to, well, I can get my email and that's being served over the internet. And then, you know, people sort of equate the internet to the cloud. And so I'll sort of take, if you will, the different sort of, you know, aspect of that from you, Steve. Because I think people's expectations for cloud computing were also sort of shaped around being able to access software from anywhere they were, right? So in the past, it was, hey, I'm locked down to a particular desktop or a particular laptop or machine, right? A physical location. And now you can say, well, I'm freed now, right? Now I can, you know, get my information wherever, and, you know, the same data I could get from my laptop, you know, I can be on the go, you know, hiking in Peru, and I can access at the same time too. Having said all that, I think also the definition of cloud or the sort of expectation of cloud are sort of shifting to new areas, right? And two I'll call out are around security and privacy, right? Increasingly, we're finding, especially at Red Hat, we're seeing customers sort of, you know, talking about, you know, in as much as I find value from being able to take advantage of, you know, deploying applications, running them, taking advantage of all the new technologies, Steve, you talked about. It's also about, you know, is this secure? You know, is this something, you know, if I'm audited that I can kind of stand behind? You know, is this complying with the regulations and the governance of the particular region that I'm working with? And then ultimately, right, are we making sure, I think maybe, you know, you've talked about this before, Steve, around GDPR or privacy or regulations that are put in place to ensure that when customers and, you know, be the individual consumers or actual enterprises, we're meeting the requirements that they've put in place to us as providers.
This is a good spot for me to jump back in here and explain some basic concepts like containers and Kubernetes. You may remember I did an episode not long ago about virtualization, and the concept of virtualization is to use software to create a virtual machine on top of an actual real physical machine. And when I say machine, I'm really talking about computers. And there are lots of different reasons that you would want to build a virtual computer on top of a physical computer. You might want to have a virtual machine dedicated to running a specific application, for example. And you want it completely separated from any other process running on the physical hardware itself. and the application might not be so demanding that it would take up all or maybe even a significant amount of a physical machine's resources. So if you did decide, I'm just going to buy a server, and that server is just going to run this one app, even though the app only relies on maybe 5% of the server's processing power and storage, you would have a ton of computing power just sitting idle, essentially going to waste. Virtual machines give you the chance to run data centers more efficiently with less idle time on computers. You could have multiple virtual machines on the same physical device, and that way you're maximizing the use of that physical hardware and you're minimizing downtime. This is increased efficiency, better savings, it just makes more sense. Containers are similar to virtualization in many ways. A container sits on top of an operating system on a computer, and containers hold all the components necessary to run some bit of code in isolation of everything else. And you can have multiple containers on the same machine, each in its own protected environment, on the same operating system. So you don't need a bunch of virtual machines on the same physical hardware. You could run containers on virtual machines, but you could also run containers just on a computer without the virtual machine and hypervisor layers. So there's no need to allocate resources to apps dynamically because the containers, quote unquote, contain everything needed to run that code. Moreover, it's easy to move those containers from environment to environment. So a developer builds some app and puts it into a few containers. The different containers are specific parts of what that app does. And then it's very easy for the developer to move those containers over to a test environment, and from there to a production environment or deployment to the cloud. You can think of containers as keeping things efficient and tidy, and they're called that because it's very much like the containers you would have in shipping. The whole idea is that you've standardized this, and it's really easy to move it around to wherever it needs to go. Okay, but what is Kubernetes? Well, that's a system that's designed to manage the deployment, scaling, and management of containerized applications. It's not the only one out there. There are other strategies for doing this, but it's one that has become incredibly popular over the last few years. So an application might require the use of several containers. Kubernetes organizes containers for applications into groups called pods, nodes, and namespaces. That's going from smallest to largest. So container is your basic unit, then you have pods, then nodes, then namespaces. I'm not going to get too much into the weeds here because it would get really kind of bogged down, but think of this as a way to coordinate all of these different containers so that the apps work the way they need to, and you can easily port it over to whatever environment you need to use. And the use of containers and orchestration strategies like Kubernetes is making it easier for developers to build and deploy apps that will work on any computing environment. All right, now let's get back to my discussion with Stephen Ashesh.
So for the average person, I think most people, if they hear about cloud computing, they're mostly thinking of public cloud applications. You know, think about cloud storage is probably the number one application that they think of.
Where's my photos and my music?
Exactly. And then if they are thinking about the apps that they're running, they might have a little bit of appreciation about that as well. But I think a lot of people who aren't in that world, they hear terms like public cloud and private cloud, and that already starts to get a little confusing to them. So could you just for a moment kind of talk about the differences? What are those entities, and what would you use public cloud for versus private cloud if you're, let's say, I don't know, a global corporation that has locations in the EU, for example?
Yeah, let me jump into that. So I'm going to try to break it down whereby we don't get so caught up in definitions that we miss the point of where we're trying to get to, right? Which is, historically, you know, we've always dealt with this, right? So we've talked about, for example, data centers, and it could be your own data center that you manage. It could be a third party that sort of managed it on your behalf. You might deploy some applications on your own. You might have someone else deploying on your behalf, and then you sort of go back and forth across them. Now, if you extend that out, and then you say, well, you know, what if we started having, and I'm going to sort of take this sort of analogy to its logical conclusion, what if we now had a vast pool of compute, network, and storage? right? And then we divvy that up to say some of it lives physically in a certain area, managed by a certain party. Some live somewhere else, managed by someone else. You can take advantage of economics because it's shared. Multiple parties can use it. And then be able to say, well, I'll deploy now those applications that I have based on policies, right? And those policies might be cost. They might be based on latency. They could be based on performance. They might be based on, you know, we talked about regulation, privacy, and governance, and so on, right? And then in that sense, does it really matter what we've called it? And this is why I think between Red Hat and IBM, you know, I think we share this vision, and I'm sure, Steve, you'd agree with this, right? That, you know, the hybrid cloud notion is, you know, really the abstraction that we can put in front of resources that can be made widely available to customers around the world. And then for us to now think about what productive things can they do on top of that? What new applications can they build? How can they integrate both existing environments they have with the new ones they want to sort of build out? How can they create greater agility and greater innovation environments?
Jumping back in here again, just to clear up a couple more things. So why would a company want to keep some stuff on premises, some in a private cloud, and some on a public cloud? Well, it has to do with a lot of different stuff, including security, governance, and cost. All this data has to ultimately live on physical machines somewhere, and it costs money to buy and maintain those machines, and they take up physical space. So there are limiting factors, mostly money and space, that restrict how many computers you're going to have in your physical location. Now, some stuff you're going to want to keep close to you. Maybe you have some trade secrets that you're protecting. Maybe you have private data on customers that you don't want leaked out to anybody else. Maybe there are specific laws in place that state you have to keep certain information under your control and you alone are allowed to have access to it. Whatever the motivation, you may want some of your data and services running on equipment that your team directly manages. So you keep all that stuff on premises or on-prem. We talk a lot about the EU in this discussion because the EU has strict rules about what data can and can't leave the continent. And in those cases, you have to make sure your system respects those restrictions if you're doing business inside the EU. Now, you might hire a third party to oversee servers running your apps, and that's all those particular servers are doing, right? They aren't running any applications for any other client on those particular servers. They might all exist in a similar data center, but the machines you're using are, quote-unquote, yours alone. You're essentially renting them. Your stuff is completely separated from anyone else's. Or maybe you've got some services you want to move to big public cloud providers, and those solutions might cost much less than running the machinery yourself. And the services guarantee redundancy. They have multiple machines holding onto your data. So if one set of servers go down, other servers with the same information can take their place. And this takes a lot of the management of that information off of your plate. So there are a lot of big companies that are using multiple cloud and on-premises solutions to host their services and their data. And as you can imagine, that gets really complicated. Just knowing where stuff is complicated. Getting stuff to work together with each other on these different platforms is even more so. And so you have to figure out how to make all this data living in these different environments to play nice together. And that's where the concept of the hybrid cloud comes into play. Let's get back to Steve and Ashish. So this kind of gets us into this concept of the hybrid cloud strategy. Can you talk a bit more about what that is and how that's going to benefit companies?
That's exactly right. So the part that we sometimes skip over, and I think this is kind of, you know, where hybrid really, really shines, is the part that, you know, Steve started talking about, right? And I think, Steve, you're describing this as sort of the two phases, yeah, right? Sure. You know, about, you know, we're about 20% of our way into the journey. We've got 80% to go. Right. Why is that really important? It's almost like an iceberg, right? We've got so much more to do, and yet we only see the tip of what we've done. Now, if you don't think of the world, you know, in a hybrid fashion, when I say hybrid, you know, I'm sort of going to call out, you know, Red Hat uses a terminology called four footprints, right? Running something in a physical environment, running something in a virtual environment, virtualized environment, running it in a private cloud, running it in a public cloud. If you don't have something that spans the four footprints, what are you doing, right? You are potentially choosing to disregard that 80% that you haven't moved over where you can make it most productive. Why is that important? Most enterprises of any size have large investments in applications, services, processes, people skills that they've made over decades. What happens to all of those, right? And if we aren't able to unlock all of that, right, how can we truly deliver innovation at the scale that we want while leaving all of that maroon on the side, right? So the opportunity to be able to say, look, I am going to be able to bridge, you know, existing investments that I've made, and IBM's obviously worked with the clients, you know, for decades around this, but at the same time expose them to what we'll call, you know, cloud native, you know, ways of working, right? This notion of microservices, right? Let me not, you know, build out massive applications, let me build them in smaller, more agile fashion. Steve talked about, you know, having APIs available, right? To make it just easier for different applications to interact with each other and be able to share information or data across them. But to be able to realize all that promise, right, we've got to be able to provide a hybrid cloud platform that spans both the new environments that we're all trying to go towards, as well as the existing applications and environment that we have running today.
And I think it's an interesting case in point. Right when we announced the acquisition intent of Red Hat, I had a CIO, executive VP of a large fast food restaurant chain call me up, and he says, okay, Steve, give me the scoop. Why'd you do it? And I had to tell him, I said, well, let's just take a look at what we're doing with you. And at that point in time, we were putting a server in every single one of those restaurants. We're putting a private cloud in every single one of his restaurants. And what we were attaching that, we were attaching our Watson services to do the ordering so that you just speak in, it would automatically handle it, et cetera, saving the labor on that, et cetera. We had also outfitted every one of his stores with IoT cameras. So all of a sudden you see the busload of high school students start to come in. He felt that if he had just a minute lead time, he could reposition his employees and be ready to take that on and manage the traffic of that. You know, those two applications resided and were critical just to that store. They didn't benefit from bouncing or sending any data back up to their data center or to the public cloud. All the processing, et cetera, needed to happen right there in the store. I said, that's your private cloud. I said, now that same store also has to order from you, do your supply chain, do your analytics, do your HR, get your paychecks, et cetera, all that. And, you know, so that's coming back into your worldwide headquarters, and that's probably running in conjunction with historical applications that you have, and probably some dedicated cloud capabilities is there. And I said, and we're also working with your marketing department on kind of running your annual sweepstakes game and doing your customer loyalty, et cetera. You want to reach as many as people across as many channels as possible. That's your public cloud, and that's what you're doing as well. I said, now imagine one architecture. So your programmers could build that once, and they could then deploy that in all three of those environments seamlessly. So you didn't have to know ahead of time where that application was going to run. You know, let's just imagine that all of a sudden speeds came up. You know, all of a sudden we're doing 5G. I can move those private cloud applications back to a center location, do that more efficiently. A single architecture gives me the ability to write it once, run it anywhere that I want to. We're starting to future-proof those applications as well.
So a hybrid cloud strategy is one that has a layer that facilitates operations across different computer environments. In an ideal version of the hybrid cloud strategy, it wouldn't matter where your data and services lived. The hybrid cloud infrastructure would create the connections necessary for services to run without any hiccups and give developers opportunities to build new applications without having to worry about some services or information being off limits. It's just sort of meant to smooth everything out and pave the way for more interoperability. Let's get back to Steve and Nishesh.
So can you talk to me a little bit about IBM's multi-cloud platform and what that means to businesses?
Sure. I think we early on decided that, you know, no firm or no enterprise is going to be wed to a single cloud, much to the chagrin of the public cloud vendors, I think. You know, we're starting to hear from some of the analysts calling it a mono cloud, you know, where they're trying to, you know, build either outposts or build, you know, some code that replicates their public cloud down into the data center so that it's more easy to go up to their public cloud. But we did a lot of work. We've done a lot of interviews with enterprise customers, and you know, they are not going to be wed to a single vendor. You know, we learned back from our prior days of working with them over the past decades, nobody likes lock-in. Everybody wants choice, and I think many of them are attracted to certain clouds based off unique capability and unique functions associated with those. Some of those may be cost-oriented, management-oriented, but you know, you're starting to see some very unique services that are pretty much wed to a single cloud as well. So we made the determination that we wanted to be one of the few vendors that could really tackle a multi-cloud problem. And we could have done two things. We could have taken our stack and custom fit it to every single cloud that's out there, plus build our own tremendous private cloud infrastructure. Or could we look at a fabric that could be consistent across these multiple environments? And this is what attracted us to our early work that we had done with Kubernetes. And then again, we were you know, it was tremendous story. Maybe I should tell the whole story on OpenShift as well, but that was unlike anything we had seen. And Red Hat both brought that fabric to the table for us, and then they already had, you know, deep relationships with all the public cloud vendors itself that, you know, it would have taken us years to develop that. So we felt that this would give us tremendous acceleration, use that beautiful foundation, that fabric and their multi-cloud relationships. And then all we had to do was right on top of that, and we start to fill out our overall multi-cloud story very rapidly here.
Yes, to add to what Steve said, which is great, and I think this is a truly a great partnership that we put together between Red Hat and IBM. The platform that, you know, we've built that IBM's taken into account here, and then it's going to sort of build out further and add additional services on top. The foundation of that is Linux. And then for the folks who follow the technology, they know, right, Linux is the foundation of, you know, pretty much every significant platform that's running out there today. Red Hat's been building that for 20 years. And what we decided was to say, well, how can we now think about, while Linux was the best platform for running applications in traditional data centers, what would be the right platform for running these applications in a hybrid cloud environment? And the lessons that we learned in building this operating system that's running mission-critical applications really all around the world, and then build the next platform on it, and that's OpenShift. And the journey we've taken, you know, for that is to really evolve that from initially being, you know, a platform where we say, well, it's an opinionated platform for a specific set of developers, to really being one that we can say is now serving a multitude of applications. So whether you're trying to run reservation systems, whether you're thinking about building your next gen, you know, web application, whether you're thinking about, you know, building software that you can stand up and run and serve to other customers in the cloud, you can now build with this same technology. And it's taking advantage of some of the concepts that Steve laid out earlier, right? These notions of, you know, containers or Kubernetes, which is container orchestration, which have now become industry standard. And so being able to now have this, what I'll call really is the industry standard platform, right? Now we're serving over 1,000 customers today running these applications at scale, along with IBM's ability to be able to now deploy this hybrid multi-cloud platform in front of its thousands of customers, you know, I think is an extremely powerful value proposition that we're laying in front of customers.
Steve and Ashish have mentioned Linux a few times. Linux is an operating system, meaning it's the software that acts as a liaison between programs and the computer hardware that makes stuff, you know, actually happen on computers. And Linux is an open source operating system with an enormous community of developers. There are numerous versions of Linux out there, and they're referred to as distros or distributions. They all share the same basic DNA, but they have different user interfaces and a few other unique aspects to each distribution. Computers running Linux make up about 90% of the workload in the public cloud. And a big reason for that is the open source nature of Linux. Because the code is open, anyone can look at it, anyone can take that code and make their own version or distribution of Linux, anyone can look for ways to improve how it works, or search out vulnerabilities and patch them. Now that's true with open source software in general, and it's why open source projects can evolve rapidly with a strong enough community contributing to those projects. All right, back to the conversation.
The next thing I want to talk about is something that I think is almost synonymous with Red Hat. It's another two-word phrase, that being open source. And, you know, Red Hat and IBM both have done incredible work around open source. I know that for my listeners, that sometimes comes as a a surprise to hear about IBM's involvement in it. That's not frequently a name that they would have associated with it. But I've been to IBM Think a couple times.
There you go.
My eyes have been opened.
We pump it into you.
Yeah. It was definitely.
These guys are the masters.
But yeah, let's talk about open source for a bit. Why is that so important? And specifically, why is it going to be critical in this world where we're looking at this cloud infrastructure for various services in different industries?
Yeah, so open source is at the beating heart. It's in the DNA, you know, use whatever way you want to describe it, you know, for Red Hat. But has been since its earliest days, right? So it's been 2 decades. Everything that we do at Red Hat is open, right? There's no code that we keep behind. Everything is shared out of the community. Why do we do that? We've believed in that from the earliest days, right? That the greatest amount of innovation that'll happen will happen out in the open. And that, by the way, has proven true, right? So if you look at the basis of, you know, critical infrastructure, you look at the basis of, you know, what you see on security, emerging technologies like blockchain, you see innovation that's been happening in big data, everything is founded on the basis of open source. That's because also large corporations, you know, whether they be providers of technology or consumers of technology, have started understanding, you know, you cannot innovate as well within your own sort of 4 virtual walls of an organization versus being able to unlock a global community of innovation, right? So this notion of crowdsourcing, this notion of collaboration, you know, however it is that you sort of want to think about it, you know, we've always believed that there's much more value that you can generate, right, when you've got hundreds of thousands of eyes looking at something, right, versus something that's just a small fraction of that. So that's one aspect, right? Which is, if you can call it the philosophical belief, you can call it that, you know, our sort of, you know, a commitment that's the way innovation must happen going forward. Another side of that, right, is that it's a smart decision for customers, right? If you're concerned about lock-in, and by the way, which customer isn't, what better way, you know, to be able to avoid that or minimize that than to rely on open source technologies, right? If your provider, your vendor isn't delivering the technology in the way you want it to, at the quality or the price that you want it, now you have the ability to go switch out to someone else who's building on that basis. And so, you know, in that way also, you know, we think there's great value that's created for customers. It also keeps us honest, right? It keeps us, as a company, always sort of looking to say, how can we continually deliver value for the price that we're charging customers. And then finally, what this also does, right, is creates, you know, what I'll call a set of open standards, right? Ways for different organizations to come together, to collaborate and start, you know, deciding, hey, this is the best way for us to sort of essentially get commonality. What often happens in technology, and Steve probably knows this as well as I do, is that the moment different choices get made, right, now enterprises are forced to pick one path. They pick the wrong path, they're now going down, you know, a road which will become a dead end soon, right? If you've got, you know, a coalescing of companies around, you know, open source and open standards, then they have a lot more confidence. Hey, I can build applications, I can build services on top of that. And of course, that'll make sure that, you know, I have something that's vibrant and that's something that has a long life. I think, Steve, you called it future-proof.
Future-proof, right.
I love those answers. I mean, Ashish, I have often referred to open source versus having the more closed-off approach. If you have the closed-off approach, you can hire the smartest people you can run into, but you can only fit so many of the smartest people into a room, yeah. Right? But on open source, you have access to all the smartest people in all the rooms. So that's I fully am on board on the open source train. I think that's where we see not just rapid innovation, but we see that rapid response when something hasn't gone right, because we all know that sometimes in software, something there's a vulnerability that someone didn't know, or maybe someone builds something new that breaks something old. When you have that community there, they recognize that so quickly and are able to respond so much more nimbly than an in-house team typically could, that I've been a big proponent of it. So it's good to see this.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. I think just case in point, I think somebody was doing some pen testing against the Kubernetes code out there, and a few vulnerabilities were found. they were patched almost within days. Mm-hmm. If you look at a commercial software vendor, I was involved in starting up the security division at IBM, and we used to track them with our X-Force work as to how long it took a commercial vendor to patch some of their code. You're talking years, if mm-hmm. ever, in some of these cases. So the speed's unbelievable here.
Well, this lets me transition, Ashesh, to a question for you. Red Hat is known for its platform neutrality, for its independence. It's been called the Switzerland of IT.
We actually used Switzerland in our board discussions on this one. It was there from day one. Yeah.
So with that in mind, what steps are you taking over at Red Hat to kind of ensure that in this new era? How do you make certain that this thing that Red Hat has been known for is protected and preserved and grown?
Yeah, I'll answer it from my perspective, and then it'd be great to hear from Steve, because then he can tell you what steps is IBM taking too, because that's important.
Not like he hasn't heard it before.
Look, we've got a saying, I think, at Red Hat, and it's probably true at IBM as well. You know, Red Hat is still Red Hat. What does that mean? That means that a big part of our value, and IBM fully recognizes this, right, as they've sort of been, you know, going through the process to get approvals to make this acquisition happen, a big part of our value is to be, you know, as you described, Jonathan, Switzerland, or neutral, or the commonality, you know, use the word of choice that you want. We firmly believe in that, right? So whether it's for us to work with, let's say, Amazon or Microsoft or Google or any of the other, you know, large providers, or other partners, right, like HPE or Dell, emerging companies, you know, a big part of what we do, right, is to be able to work with these companies, have commercial relationships with them, also collaborate in the community with them, right? And then sometimes, you know, those two work together really well. And other times, you know, we have to sort of make sure that we balance across them, right, to sort of keep terms consistent and fair. So our focus really is that we are going down that path and we're going to continue going down that path. We haven't really changed any of that. Of course, you know, with the opportunity with IBM is to be able to go and avail our customers with you know, a lot greater reach than we've had before. But that independence that we had, the broad ecosystem that we've cultivated of providers, of partners around the world, we continue to work with it. And so, you know, oftentimes when the question sort of comes back, you know, my response, and I don't want it to sound glib, is to say business as usual, right? We've worked a certain way. It's been reasonably successful, we'd like to believe, and we want to keep continuing going down that path.
All right. It's been several weeks since Red Hat and IBM came together. And the question is the honeymoon over? How have things been? How's the transition going? What have you learned so far?
Oh, I should probably start this one.
There we go. Yeah. When the honeymoon started.
Well, it's been a whirlwind, right? So the good news is it wasn't a surprise.
It was a long engagement.
Yes, exactly. We've been working through it for a while. I think maybe what the surprising part has been is that there is so much more in common than we thought there was. What do I mean by that? It's, you know, IBM has invested in, Steve talked about this, you know, the commitment to Linux, the long relationship that IBM Red Hat has had. There's a lot of work that's happened from an engineering perspective, right, with collaboration over the years that we had in place. So, you know, just this sort of notion of, hey, we're actually working with, you know, people that many parts of the company have worked with in the past, you know, has been good. I think also the realization on both sides to sort of respect, you know, both parties, if you will, culture and heritage, right? You know, IBM obviously has a long storied one, but all the work that we've done with Steve and his team and, you know, the large IBM organization in general, you know, has been extremely positive. I think, you know, both parties have now done work they've essentially established, you know, what I'll call, for lack of a better way to describe them, you know, offices within sales organization, the products team to interface with IBM. And so, you know, every person at Red Hat doesn't feel like, you know, I've got to engage with a dozen folks from IBM and vice versa. You know, we have some, you know, sort of processes to be able to do that. And I think that's important, right? Because, you know, we talked a little bit about Red Hat still being Red Hat, you know, the business that we're pursuing, the work that we're trying to do, the neutrality that, you know, we want to sort of, you know, keep in place as we go forward and do that. And so it's important for all that to happen. So
We've seen all of that, and I think that's been great. We've also seen the ability, you know, for us to reach out to customers, to have different conversations. I don't know, I was getting pulled into conversations with some customers, you know, who we've never previously engaged with, mostly because they said, hey, you know, we work very closely with IBM, and the CIO of the large insurance organization said, you know, I'd love for you and your team to sort of come up and meet with us and talk about, you know, what we've done. Well, that's opening up new things. And more of, you know, when that happens, right, I think, you know, there's a greater level of comfort within Red Hat to say, yeah, this was really good, right? So it's one hand to sort of think it, and the other hand to kind of, you know, see it and say, you know, our culture is in place, the way we're working is in place, our neutrality is in place, our independence is in place, and there are newer and bigger opportunities opening.
So I think that's good. You know, we had this concept better together. You know, let's kind of, I think one of the biggest fears is we turned 400,000 people of IBM loose on Red Hat. And, you know, I've probably spent over half of my career in acquisitions at IBM, from Lotus to Rational to, you know, multiple security companies, et cetera. And I've seen both the good and I've seen the bad. And the nice thing, I think we worked very closely together during the closing period as to putting the right type of gates in place so that, you know, the right discussions could be had at the right time, but there wasn't this full inundation of activity from both sides. IBM can be a little overwhelming sometimes. But again, you know, this, you know, buying a strong growth company that had 60 plus quarters worth of double digit growth, we were very dependent on them just doing what they're doing as well. But as I said, I think, you know, we've been doing a lot of account planning right now. I think you see a lot of excitement between the two teams. A lot of things we could not talk about pre-close that we're now able to talk about. So we can now actually, you know, share information that we have on our customer sets, who has what are new opportunities. And I think the teams are just overly excited as we kind of look at some of the first key accounts that we're jointly just looking at to see how can we serve them better. And I think we're getting a lot of excitement back from our client base as well. So we're excited. I don't think we're keeping our eyes open to look for friction points as we move forward. I think we've got some good mechanisms in place to address those fairly quick. You know, we're doing this podcast from the Red Hat building. You still see Red Hat on top. You still see the logo in the front. We're not changing anything as well. So, you know, this whole independence, this Switzerland, Red Hat is still Red Hat. You know, we're taking that very serious. And there's a few ex-IBMers on the Red Hat side. They're like, wow, you guys are really taking this serious. And I think that's reflecting in a lot of comments here.
I want to thank IBM and Red Hat for having me out to Raleigh to talk about this partnership and what it means. Now, ultimately, their goal is to create a service that lets other companies build better apps for end users, whether that's folks like me and you or other companies or even just people within that organization itself. So IBM and Red Hat are building out the stuff that makes other people's stuff work, in other words. And it can be difficult to get an appreciation for that. I know that I've been guilty at looking at the surface level of a service or an app and not really taking into consideration what's required to, you know, actually work. So this gave me a deeper appreciation of that. And frankly, I'm excited to see where this goes, because it could mean that the sort of things that you and I interact with on a daily basis, whether it's an app, a program on our desktops or laptops, maybe it's Internet of Things related, could be a service that we don't even realize is connected to the cloud. All of those can become more robust, more feature-rich, they can work better, we can have fewer vulnerabilities, fewer hiccups. That's the ideal future that we could see, and I'm really hoping that that's what we get. And ultimately, if it works well, we probably won't even think about it. That's kind of the way things work. And we know that everything's going well if that happens. So thanks again to IBM and Red Hat. Thank you guys for listening. I hope you enjoyed this bonus episode of Tech Stuff, and I'll talk to you again really soon. Tech Stuff is a production of iHeartRadio's How Stuff Works. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.